Hey friends, Chuck Mingo here. Thank you so much for joining me for another episode of Living Undivided. You know, let's face it, conversations around race are challenging all the time. And oftentimes because of the challenge, they kind of get either, you know, you either get shouted down or you feel like you're just in hushed tones around it. But we are a part of a movement of people who have said, we're going to bring these conversations into the light, seasoned with love and grace, and actually seasoned with historical understanding. And so we've seen thousands of people engage in conversations across racial lines through Living Undivided, and it's making a difference, not just in relationships, but in how people show up in the world. It's making a difference in communities all across the country. And we wanna do this show every week because we wanna give you inspiration that you too can be a part of these conversations, not just a part of the conversations, but a part of making change in the areas of racial solidarity and racial justice. And so every week I want to send you or bring you someone that just will inspire you, someone who's walking down this path. And I'm really excited for you to meet the person that I have on the show today. I'm going to start with a quote from Malcolm X. Malcolm X said, armed with the knowledge of our past, we can with confidence charter a course for our future. You've probably heard that in a number of different ways from a number of different people. And I do, in fact, believe that it's true. So we're going to talk a little bit about history today. So first, let me ask you a question. The question is, who is your favorite historical figure? Now, a lot of the people who follow me are Christ followers like myself. And so I'm going to challenge you, besides Jesus, who may be at the top of your list. He's certainly at the top of my list. But who else? Who else would you say is a historical figure that you look to? Well, we're going to ask my guest that question today when he comes on, and he has a variety of answers he could give because he's kind of a historian. His name is CJ Kordelbaum, and he is a writer and a speaker from Brooklyn, New York. He's written for The Witness, The Gospel Coalition, and Christ in Pop Culture. He's the author of a biweekly newsletter through the publication he started called Live and Labor, and the goal there is to provide Christians with simple teachings for living the way of Jesus. I've read his writings and been very inspired by him. In addition to this, he's teaching a course entitled Black History Reexamined. And we're going to get into that today because he believes that one of the paths to us healing the racial divide is actually learning more of our shared history. In his personal life, he's an avid reader. He's a basketball player and a foodie. And most of the time you can find him spending time with his wife and two, soon to be three, children. Welcome to the club of No More Man to Man when it comes to parenthood. You are now in zone defense, and you can follow him on Twitter at CJ_Kordelbaum. We're going to put that so you can see it. But welcome my new friend, CJ Kordelbaum, to Living Undivided. What's up, CJ?
Hey, what's going on, Chuck? Good to be with you this morning.
It is good to have you here, man. Yeah, you're moving from two to three when it comes to kids. So it's zone defense time. You know about that from playing basketball.
I'm terrified. Is it okay for me to say that? I'm terrified.
It's okay. It's okay for you to be terrified. It's okay. In fact, I would say something's wrong with you if you're not thinking very soberly about that. But it will be, as I know you know, as a father of two, an incredible blast.
I'm not just moving from two to three, though. I've got a three-year-old and a one-year-old, and I'm adding a newborn to that.
Woo! Yeah, that's like exponential math right there. The number of diaper changes goes up exponentially when you make that addition. Lord. So, spoken as one diapers. Who is finally out of that. I'm finally out of diapers, and I'm very happy to be out of the diaper phase. But it's all good, man. But hey, thanks so much for being with me. You and I, we had a conversation a week ago, and I just walked away from it with such fresh insights about specifically history and the role that history can play in racial healing. And so I just thought it'd be great to have you on to share what you're learning, to invite our guests to really engage with you in that work. And I will start by asking you the question that I asked them, which I'm sure is a hard question as a person who cares about history as much as you. But who is your favorite historical figure besides Jesus? Who's your favorite?
Besides Jesus. I think right now it's Fannie Lou Hamer. Mm-hmm. And as I think about her and the life that she lived, Fannie lived through so much. She'd been beaten, jailed. She was in the Jim Crow South, Mississippi, fighting for equal rights for Black people.
Yeah.
And it was her faith that guided her. And it was her faith that caused her to never waver. And that to me is, when I look at all these other historical figures and I'm like, you did some great work. You were awesome. But to see the evidence of faith in Fannie, holding her down, keeping her up, Mm-hmm. It's that makes me look at her and go, that's a model that I want to follow.
Man, I love that. I love that. She's a powerful, powerful story that doesn't often get told in terms of the journey and the struggle for where we are today. So Fannie Lou Hamer, man, be worth people digging into her who haven't already. Let's dig into a little bit of your history. So tell me a little bit about yourself, or tell our listeners a little bit about you, life growing up, all of that.
So I am from Brooklyn. If you talk to me for more than 10 minutes, you'll hear that at least 5 times. I love Brooklyn more than Drake loves Toronto. That's the way I like to say it. And then on top of that, my mother is from the beautiful island of Trinidad, just off the coast of Venezuela. And so there are two people in this world who have extreme pride in where they're from, and it's Trinidadians and Brooklynites. And I get to sit in the perfect nexus of both.
Oh, my goodness. So, oh, my goodness.
Brooklyn kid. I grew up in church because, as I like to say, if you're Black, you come with a praying grandmother. She's just a part of the package.
Amen to that.
I didn't actually become a believer until I was 22. Probably because of the prayers of that praying grandmother. But I was a Christian spoken word artist at the time that I became a believer. I had been taught that Christianity was like this light switch. You just flip on and off when you're ready. And so, you know, in junior high, in high school, after college, I was like, this is it. This is the time. And, you know, with no heart change, flipping a switch does absolutely nothing. Mm-hmm. And so I end up in a room with Matt Chandler and Eric Mason for about 10 hours. And I'm telling you, if you walk into a room.
And let's just step back, because not everybody's going to be familiar with those names. I'm familiar with those names. So Matt Chandler, pastor in Dallas, Denton, Texas, strong, strong preacher, just committed, committed pastor. And Eric Mason, who's a personal favorite of mine from my hometown, Philadelphia, and also just a powerful, powerful preacher. So you got double teamed in a room to have both of those preachers connecting with you.
I promise, if you sit in a room with the two of them for 10 hours, and you are not a believer, you're walking out following Jesus. You're walking out questioning a lot of things about your life. And it was really beautiful, because it was the first time that I truly had ears to hear the gospel. And it was really interesting. At the end, Matt Chandler gets up and he goes, you know, we're not Christians because of our church activity. We're not Christians because our parents are Christians. Mm-hmm. We're not Christians because we grew up in church. And like every reason I would have given you to justify myself before God, he named and said, we are Christians because of who Jesus is and what he has done. So that was April 10th, 2010. So just about 10 and a half years ago now. Wow. And since then, I've been to seminary. I've worked in ministry. I worked for a missions organization for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And now I'm doing Live in Labor and my other big project, Labor Forward. As you can tell, I have this like laboring theme in my life.
Yes.
You
know, yes.
Doing the work.
Well, I want you to talk a little bit about those two. But first, I think it's helpful. This was interesting to me to say, like, you didn't start with Live in Labor. You didn't start with Labor Forward. You didn't even start with what you're doing around reexamining history. You actually thought you were going to plant a church, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that was your vision. You went to seminary. You're going to be a church planter.
I become a believer in 2010. Mm-hmm. In about 2011, 2012, I'm like, hey, someone needs to plant a church in New York. Someone, not me, just someone. And what happened? My sister graduated from Columbia with two master's degrees. Wow. If you know anything about an immigrant family, if one does something, you are immediately being asked, what are you going to do?
Right.
My sister, she gets these two master's, and my dad looks at me. He goes, all right, what are you going to do? And I'm like, well, I'm trying to decide between business school and seminary. And because, you know, in a lot of times in Black church culture, being in ministry is just so, it's so pedestaled. It's like, my dad was like, all right, well, if you go to seminary, I will pay for your first year, which he didn't do, but it was enough to get me to apply.
He just so got you to move.
Yeah. I was like, all right, I guess I'll give it a shot if you'll pay for it, which I should call him about that. He owes me some money. But I applied to one school and I got in, and I kind of go through seminary. And so this was 2012. I start seminary. In 2013, I have church planting networks offering me boatloads of money to go plant a church. They're like, hey, you are young, you're vibrant, you're Black, you want to plant in the city? Go. We'll fund you. And that scared the life out of me. Because I'm like, I'm 3 years in here. I haven't even been a part of a healthy church yet. My doctrine isn't fully formed. I am in no position, just because I can maybe preach a little well and people are drawn to me, I'm in no position to go out and plant a church. So yeah. I decided to take my time, and I said I wasn't going to plant without getting some pastoral experience first.
Okay.
So I end up working for a missions organization, mm-hmm. and the summer of 2016 happens. And it's specifically the week that Philando Castile and Alton Sterling mm-hmm. were both murdered.
Yeah.
And I was sitting in church crying like a baby. And it was just something in that moment that sparked. And I said, I need to write about this. Mm-hmm. See, if you had asked me when I was 10, CJ, what do you want to do when you grow up? The answer was write and be left alone. At 30, the answer is still write, be left alone, but also go speak and teach and lead in those things. So just give me my quiet time.
Yes. Yes.
I started writing again. And mm-hmm. that writing ended up opening doors to go speak in places. I did this very weird Midwestern tour where I found mm-hmm. myself in La Crosse, Wisconsin, in Grand Forks, North Dakota, in Minneapolis, Minnesota, but always mm-hmm. in the dead of winter. But here I am.
Poor planning. Who was your agent? Who was scheduling those dates for you?
we'll have to have a conversation with her. It was beautiful because I ended up in these really, really white places mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. speaking about racial justice and the gospel to college students. Mm. And the most amazing part was we got to have good conversation, good, pure conversation. I can't think of a single time where it was combative. I can't mm-hmm. think of a single time where people felt disrespected. Mm-hmm. And that was, to me, I was like, okay, I need to keep going. But as I continued and I started to have more conversations, one thing that I saw was just how terrible Black history knowledge was everywhere. Yeah. So I eventually got out of the Midwest and, you know, got to go to the South when it was sunny sometimes and to mm-hmm. some other mm-hmm. places. But all over, I just kept seeing the same thing. I had a conversation with someone and I mentioned Harriet Tubman. And he said to me, I'm not familiar. I don't know who that is. Wow. And I said, hold on. Harriet Tubman is Black History 101.
Right,
if
right.
If you don't know Harriet, we've got some serious problems.
Wow.
And so that was kind of the seed that was planted in my mind for Labor Forward.
Okay.
I was like, all right, well, I'm going to start out easy. I'm going to make a Black History calendar. 365 uh-huh. days, person, place, thing, big event in Black history. Mm-hmm. But as time goes on, my mind starts to percolate a little more and I start to come up with these different ideas. And one was Black History Reexamined. I was like, hey, why don't I teach, you know, a 4-8 session course on this subject? Why don't I go into schools and go to nonprofit organizations just all over the place, just offer it to people. Let's learn Black history together. Let's reexamine what we've been taught.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. I mean, the interesting thing is you take this route. Obviously, you observed an absence of knowledge. What else would you say is just kind of an objective critique about how we teach history as a country that you observed or noticed or that you're trying to maybe correct through Black History Reexamined?
I think we teach a very one-sided notion of history. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the old adage that history is written by the victors. Mm-hmm. And I think that's so true. You have textbooks in Texas right now that say enslaved people came here as indentured servants, that they mm-hmm. came here seeking a better life. And it's mm-hmm. like, no, they mm-hmm. were stolen from their land. They were captives. They did not come here willingly. Mm-hmm. I think I took AP US history in high school mm-hmm. and I remember the Great Migration being two, maybe three paragraphs.
Yes. This massive thing that, you know, Isabel Wilkerson, I think The Warmth of Other Suns is probably one of the best books on the subject, right? I mean, she's got a whole volume on this, but it was 2-3 paragraphs in your AP history course.
Yes. Wow. And then I think about just what we're taught. You know, we're essentially taught slavery, civil rights movement, everything's better, Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, the little old lady who wouldn't get up on the bus, even though mm-hmm. she was only in her 40s. And as someone in their 30s, I understand just how young 40 is now.
Right.
And so, you know, it's like we hear about two events and three, maybe four people.
Yeah.
I went to a high school that was named after civil rights leader A. Philip Randolph. Mm-hmm. And in 4 years there, no one ever told us who he is, who he was.
Wow. And the school was named after him.
The school was named after him. The school was entirely Black and brown. Not once did they sit us down and say, this is the man whose legacy you're carrying.
Wow. Wow. And CJ, the thing about that that I see in the work that I do is without having that common knowledge of our history, we can't find a starting ground for where we need to go forward in this conversation. So it's almost like learning a different language. In fact, some of the ways that I would articulate it is I often say, and sadly, this is true. I think if you are Black and brown in this country and you have parents who have wanted to make sure that you had a better view of Black history in particular, you're armed with these perspectives and stories and knowledge and names that you just recognize later people don't have. And I find that when white Americans in particular learn the things that have been omitted from their knowledge of history, in some ways, it's a grieving process for them.
Yeah.
Because they realize, like, this is so substantial and important to the story of our country. How am I supposed to feel about my favorite fifth grade history teacher now?
Yeah.
When they didn't articulate any of this to me, right?
Yeah. And, you know, when I encounter people who are having those feelings, I tell them, you know, don't blame your history teacher, because chances are they didn't know either.
Right.
This is not, unfortunately, it's not common knowledge.
Yeah.
Like, it's baffling to me that because of the HBO shows Watchmen and Lovecraft Country, mm-hmm. that now people know about Tulsa.
Yeah.
That was a huge event that upended so many lives. Absolutely. And completely changed the trajectory of an entire city.
Totally.
And it took some fictional TV shows for us to learn about it.
In 2020 or 2019, maybe they came out in 2019, but they're currently literally on the air right now. Yeah.
100 years later.
Yeah. Wow, man. So tell me what you're doing with reexamining history. What's that look like? You said 4 to 8 sessions. How's it going? What are you doing to kind of bring people into this now?
Yeah. So I just started writing the course. I'm piloting it now, but I'm essentially, and it depends on, you know, how I'm going to teach this to people. I'm offering it during Black History Month for people to sign up for, which mm-hmm. I will, if they follow me on the socials, I'll be giving out details later. And that'll I'll probably condense that down into 4 sessions just to kind of get one each week. But I talk mm-hmm. about slavery and capitalism, how it mm-hmm. made America into the superpower that it is. I talk about the Great Migration and specifically mm-hmm. how cities were shaped. Like most people don't know that there was a time where cities essentially looked like grids and mm-hmm. every neighborhood was really walkable. But then mm-hmm. because of government intervention and government policy, highways were built that literally ran through and divided cities. And the people who paid for that were Black and brown people.
In I-75 in Cincinnati, the west end of Cincinnati was a cohesive, connected, predominantly African-American neighborhood. And you're right. I-75, there was an intentional choice to literally split that neighborhood in half.
Yeah. So
that happened in cities across the country. Right.
Dallas, LA are really great examples. Mm-hmm. New York. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I talk about prosperity. You know, that Reconstruction era, Black flourishing and white burning is what I've termed it. But you see all of the Black Wall Streets pop up and slowly but surely they are dismantled by varying factors of white supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
I take a look at all the disparities, the inequality we experience in health, education, economically, just all the different ways. And then one of my favorite sessions is I called it, we smart, Black invention. The country. Little is known about the great Black inventors of the 19th and 20th century that literally helped push this country to these modern times that we're in today.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about our leaders through the years. I talk about our art. And then the last session is sort of an Afrofuturism session. What does the future look like for us? What does it look like for us to dream as a people?
Mm. Man, I tell you what, sign me up. We're going to be putting information on the stream here for people to connect with you on social and learn more about what you're doing with reexamining history. Because, man, I was so inspired when I heard your vision. And I want you to talk about this other piece of your vision that really gripped me, which is this isn't just about a class. This isn't just about students understanding history, but talk about some of the other things that you dream of, your own Afro future that you're dreaming of right now.
Oh man, I'm an avid reader. I'm one of those annoying 50 books a year kind of people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And every time you see me, there's a book in my hand, and I read a bit of everything. Mm-hmm. And I read Hamilton a couple of years ago. And as I'm sitting and reading Hamilton, the guy who wrote it, Ron Chernow, great writer, beautiful writer, He's got a book on, and Hamilton's about 800 pages. He's got about 1,000 pages on Ulysses S. Grant.
Yeah.
He's got a couple of hundred, I think it's about 6 or 7 on George Washington. Mm-hmm. He's got some on some other people. And I looked and I'm like, all right, that's cool. And then there's this other guy, Dave McCullough, who writes about big events. And
absolutely. He's got like
1776.
Yeah.
He's got a book on the Brooklyn Bridge. And there's these massive, thick volumes.
Mm-hmm.
And then I read a book about Frederick Douglass. And that was about 800 pages or so. And I read one on Martin Luther King, and that was about 800 pages or so. But I stopped to think. Chernow and McCullough, they've got the game on lock.
They
have got history market just cornered.
Mm-hmm.
But they're writing about largely white events and white people.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've got Douglass and we've got King. We've got a ton of books on them. But I started to think to myself, I'm like, who's writing the book about Fannie Lou Hamer?
Yeah.
Who's writing the book about A. Philip Randolph, Mega Evers, Frank and Mamie Clark, Shirley Chisholm? Like, I can go on and on down the list. Like, we've got enough books on MLK and Frederick Douglass. And please, if there's some new scholarship, I welcome it.
Bring it out. But right. Mm-hmm.
We have a treasure trove of more people that need to be written about. And so my big dream is to be able to hire historians, real true historians, much better than myself, to write these books. Because these stories need to be told. They need to be a part of the curriculum.
Yes. Yes, man. And there's something that happens when you see yourself in history, right?
Yeah.
When you see your contribution, and this could be true for every race, every nationality, every ethnicity in our country. There are heroes of all walks of life that have contributed to the success of this country. And I love your vision to say, let's elevate those stories and let's have more people experience them. So I got two final questions for you as we're getting tight on time here, man. I could talk to you for an hour, hour and a half. This would be great. We could make this multiple series or multiple episodes. But the one question is this: as a person who studies history and a person who is living in the present, which is 2020 and all that is going on right now in our country, what gives you hope about the future? What gives you hope that we won't just repeat these same patterns of racial division and pain that have been, unfortunately, the patterns in our country to date?
What gives me hope is that I know how the story ends. Revelation 7 says, I see people of all tribes, tongues, and nations together worshiping the Lamb. And then I think of the Dr. King quote that the arc of history is long, but it bends towards justice. Amen. So my hope is in the God who rules over all and sees over all, that knowing that he is not a liar. So it's right there.
I love it. I love it. Deeply, deeply encouraging to go right back to the source, because there is a bigger story that's greater than the American story, the global story right now. And it's the story that God is writing. And we know how that story ends. That's a good word, man. So tell our listeners, what would be your next step for them? The thing that you would invite them into? And then I want you to just finish this sentence. What does it mean to you to live undivided?
So next step, I say, hey, follow me on the socials. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at CJ_Quarterbaum. And then you can also follow, I just created it this weekend, so there's no post, but follow it anyway. All Labor right. Forward. That is the entity under which all of my Black history work is going. So as I get ready to start promoting the course and releasing details on that, you'll find it on there. So please give both of those a follow. And then I'd say living undivided for me is, it's living in harmony. It's living freely together. It is. So my wife is half Italian, half Irish. And we didn't even get into this. My wife is white. My kids are biracial. It's us being able to walk down the street with no looks, no glances.
Yep. Yeah.
We're all people living together and prayerfully one day all worshiping together.
That's right. Man, that's so good. Well, CJ, you have blessed me on now multiple occasions, just hearing your heart, your passion, your vision. And I think you've done the same for our listeners as well. I believe that, you know, should the Lord tarry, which is an old church term, right? That's an old church term. So, you know, I do believe that the next chapter of the story is the return of Christ, and that things will be made right. And should that delay, I can see stories being written about you, my friend, and what you're building right now and the impact that you're going to have. I'm just super excited for it. So thanks so much for being on Living Undivided. God bless you, man. And we will continue to have this conversation for sure.
Thanks for having me.
Dude, I'm so inspired by CJ. I hope that you are as well. And I hope that in what he said, there is something for you to grasp onto. And that is, think about the history that you learned and think about the contributions from people who don't look like you, and get curious. Get curious, pick up books about the contributions that Latinx people have made to our culture here in America, Asian contributions, contributions from other people from Southeast Asia. There's all kinds of stories out there, and hopefully more that will be written. If you've not read about Fannie Lou Hamer, if you've not read about some of the names that he mentioned, then I encourage you to pick up a book, get curious, because if you have a common history and a common view, then that means that we can shape a common future where everybody can thrive, where everyone can live undivided. Thanks for being with me. I'll see you next time.